You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 428. If you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always gotten. Tony Robbins.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, guys, before I get started, don't forget that we are having our New Year's sale over at IFH Academy. If you want to get up to 70% off of all of our courses, webinars, workshops, and masterclasses, head over to ifhacademy.com. Now, guys, I've been getting a lot, and I mean a lot, of messages, comments, posts about film festivals and what should filmmakers do now during COVID, and is it worth submitting to film festivals, even the big film festivals, if there's no physical festival to go to, if it's only online, is it really worth it? What am I supposed to do? So I reached out to the film festival expert, Christopher Hollins, over at filmfestivalsecrets.com. And Chris is a returning champion. He's been on the show before. And we teamed up to put together the Film Festival Hack Limited Series podcast to help filmmakers understand the world of film festivals. Now, in our conversation, we discussed the pros and cons of submitting to film festivals in today's crazy world. What value film festivals even have in the current marketplace in regards to distribution and getting a better deal, and if festivals can even bounce back from the brutal hit that they've taken from the COVID pandemic. If you're thinking of submitting to a film festival within the next year to 2 years, this is the episode for you. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Christopher Holland. I'd like to welcome back to the show, returning champion, Christopher Holland. How you doing, brother?
I'm hustling, man. I'm hustling.
Every day you're hustling, hustling.
That's right.
It is a weird and wacky world that we find ourselves in, isn't it, sir?
It is. It is. And it feels weird to keep saying that, but it's, you know, it just gets weirder. Like every week, I feel like the things we knew or thought we knew have changed, and, you know, gotta adjust, gotta figure out the game plan.
I feel like we are in Back to the Future 2, and we have taken a different timeline, and we're living in a different timeline.
You went for the dark one. You went for two, huh?
Oh, yeah, the dark timeline. Yeah, like the one that everything just skewed into, like, all hell, into a dystopian.
It's so prescient. I mean, Biff is clearly modeled on Donald Trump.
Well, you know, we try to stay apolitical on the show, sir. But but just the general craziness of that is where we're at in this world. It's insane. If I would have told you in January, hey, South by Southwest is going to get canceled completely a few weeks before it launches, you would have just looked at me going, you're out of your mind.
That was shocking
to everybody.
For people who are tuned into indie film at all, much less people who work at a film festival, it's going to be like, where were you when you heard the shuttle exploded, or where were you when JFK was shot? Right. It's like, you remember, where were you when you heard South by Southwest was canceled? And that feeling of just, it is shocking how suddenly that happened and how long it took them to figure out what they were going to do next.
They got caught in the buzzsaw. Poor things.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 And, you know, they're going to find their way back for sure. But, I mean, it's too big of a thing not to.
Austin
has changed its entire – it's like poured itself into a South by Southwest-shaped mold. That's how many conference rooms and ballrooms and bars and restaurants they've built to support South by Southwest. But it was a blow for sure.
To Austin and to the filmmakers that were accepted. And
to everybody.
To everybody, and they're not paying, they're not refunding anybody's money, so all that goes into next year. Like it's insane. It's just the whole world's insane. So I wanted to bring you on the show again, sir, because film festivals are, you know, taking an absolute beating with this, and it is, in my opinion, changed the landscape for film festivals from this point on. I don't think film festivals will ever be the same again. And I think a lot of them will probably go away. The smaller ones that are not robust enough will probably end up going away, which I think is a travesty because there is a place for film festivals in the ecosystem of independent film, even with Netflix and streaming and all that kind of stuff. So from your point of view, what is the word on the street from film festivals? What have you been hearing of, like, how they're dealing, what's going on, all that kind of stuff?
Well, how they're dealing is highly dependent on when their festival was scheduled to be, i.e. how much time they had to figure their stuff out. What's your cursing policy on this show?
I generally like to keep it as clean as possible, but if an F-bomb drops, it drops.
All right. No, I've converted over to the Good Place version of, you know, holy mother forking shirt balls. It makes me happy. Even on my iPhone autocorrects. So if I type S-H-I-T, it types shirt.
Yes, exactly.
It makes me happy. Anyway, so I had to check in there. People are seeing how the sausage is made in this podcast game.
Yes, exactly.
So, what were we talking about?
Film festivals on the street. On the street. Reacting. Yes.
So, yeah, how long they had to figure out their stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, for me personally, I work at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. We closed our doors for our annual 2020 festival on, basically March 1st.
Sure.
And then 2 weeks later, the world exploded. We had no idea that we were probably, you know, a transmission vector. We may or may not have been, depending on who you believe. But still, you know, we got in right under the wire. So we have a year to figure out what our next festival looks like. And so for us, you know, we've done all our fundraising and all that kind of stuff. We've got that runway. Things don't look so bad. But we're still sort of like figuring it out. And then there's, what do we do in the meantime? And a lot of festivals who had year-round programming in person have switched over to digital. Not only are they holding screenings digitally, but they're also doing more Skype Q&As where they might not have done any Q&A. Like they can't afford for one screening to fly a filmmaker in. So they're doing more virtual stuff. They're exploring what the options are. Mm-hmm. They're copying ideas from other industries and from other events like MAD. And that's great, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's trying to figure out how this works. And there's been this panoply of streaming services that sort of, have swelled up and either figured out how to do virtual events real darn fast or already had it in the works. And so mm-hmm. they were ready. I went to the Art House Convergence, which is a gathering of art house theaters, other exhibitors, distributors, and film festivals in Utah about a week before Sundance. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple of virtual people come up to me and go, hey, you know, like if you ever want to run a virtual film festival, all of us being completely oblivious of COVID at that point.
Right.
And I blew them off mostly because it was like I'd done my thing with virtual festivals in the past. It's great if you don't have access to the theater for whatever reason, but, you know, people like to go to events. So I wasn't taking it all that seriously. And right. then, you know, a month later, it's like, oh, crap. Now I got to go back to all these people and say about that. Mm-hmm. So some, you know, of these companies have done really, really well and are growing like mad because film festivals are now suddenly interested in virtual events. I think you're going to see most festivals. And this is, you know, come true for the most part for those festivals that have happened or announced plans since this all started. Most of them are going to go like at least half digital, if not entirely digital. Mm. A lot of them are going to try and figure out how to do something in person. You know, they're going to try drive-in movies, which have suddenly become a thing again. They're going to try socially distanced stuff. There's a theater or two in town here in Atlanta that is actually letting people go to the movies. But
that seems like a good idea.
Well, the problem is, they made those plans and made those decisions based on information from a month ago when we thought that COVID was spread by surfaces and by, you know, specks of liquid that came out of your mouth, flew a few feet, and then fell to the ground. Right. Well, that's not how COVID works. We understand now that it's actually completely airborne and can float in the air. And the more people, infected people you put in a box, you know, with no ventilation or little ventilation, the more that viral load is going to build up in the air around you,
right,
to the point where anybody who's in that box is going to get infected.
And you could just go back and look at that scene from Outbreak when they're actually in a movie theater, and it's pretty much that.
Yep, exactly. So I'm not an expert on the virus.
Sure.
I read the same crap that everybody else does, but it's becoming very clear that the rules from a month ago, 2 months ago, are not the real rules. And so all of these restaurants that are claiming, you know, they wipe all the surfaces down and everything, you know, but they're still inviting you to come in and be in an enclosed space with poor ventilation, you know, that's a really, really bad idea. And so movies are the same way. So when I see places like Sundance, places like Toronto, whoever, who are like, we're going to do some socially distanced things, I'm like, well, okay, but that's based on information from a month ago. Are you really going to still do that now? Because it seems like a really bad idea now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, look, film festivals in general have been a cultural event since its inception. So it is about gathering people together to celebrate film, celebrate independent film, or, you know, whatever. But generally, it's about celebration of independent film in some sort of event, a physical event. Can film festivals survive without a theatrical component? I know the big boys will figure a way out, but I'm talking about that little festival down the street. I always say Moose Jaw, the Moose Jaw International Film Festival, which I hope doesn't exist. Or as in my movie, the Uptown Downtown Film Festival. So, you know, so the Uptown Downtown Film Festival that's been around for maybe 4 years, and, you know, they rent out the local pub and they have, you know, maybe 40 or 50 people show up and they hand out a couple of certificates. And there's thousands of those kind of festivals around.
So here's where I talk in sweeping generalities.
Yes.
The Uptown Downtown Film Festival, those guys probably weren't making any money anyway.
Okay.
They were, you know, probably staffed by volunteers who mm-hmm. just love putting on a film festival.
Sure.
And if there was any money changing hands, it was to the venues that they had to pay, or, you know, whatever travel they were paying for, or, you know, just operational stuff. You mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. the people who were running that film festival were not making the money. Mm-hmm. And so those people are going to be they have a choice. They can cancel. Mm-hmm. They can go online. They can try to hold something in person, but, you know, monetarily that's not going to work out because most places have social distancing rules. And if you can't sell half of your house, then the rental fee is just going to put you underwater.
Right.
Not to mention the distributor's fee if you have to pay that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the downside. The upside is it didn't cost them much to spin up in the first place, and they can probably, with a Kickstarter campaign or, you know, some of their savings or a credit card or whatever, spin back up again. Film festivals are inherently volatile. When I look at a film festival for legitimacy, I generally don't look at anything younger than about 6 years, because that's about the point that a festival matures and figures out whether it really wants to do what it's doing or not,
right,
and how to make it viable.
Right.
So there's always been this churn of film festivals, little film festivals coming and going all the time. COVID-19 may have accelerated that process. Maybe a lot more will go under, but you know, there's always festivals popping up as somebody gets the bright idea. Well, we need a good film festival in this town, and the one that used to be here is gone, or there's never been one, and those will pop up. As you said, the big boys, I don't know if they're going to be fine, but
they'll survive. They'll survive in one way, shape, or form. But
the one that seems to be in the most trouble, and I say this only based on the press, mm-hmm, is Toronto, because
really?
They've got this huge honking theater, the Lightbox.
Yeah.
That was already costing them a ton of money to operate. If you look at their ticket pricing, especially for like their celebrity events, they were charging like $40-$50 a pop,
mm-hmm,
because this thing costs a lot to maintain. And now, you know, they got no revenue whatsoever, you know, mostly speaking. Mm-hmm. And the Lightbox has been shut since March or April. Mm-hmm. They've laid off a bunch of people. You know, that it's tough to come back from that in the same way that you did before.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, it's not like this goes on forever and ever. There will be a vaccine someday. You know, my bet is on late 2021. But again, I'm not an, mm-hmm, expert. I'm just sort of like intuiting, you know, reading between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's every possibility that they'll be back in business with a, you know, if not a fully, you know, fleshed out, big as it ever was film festival, at least an event that sort of starts getting them back on their feet. I imagine there will be a certain amount of state support of,
right, because
arts
it's Canada.
Organizations. I mean,
sure.
Toronto has more film festivals, you know, in its city than I think any other city in the world. Partially that's because of Toronto, because Toronto is such a big, you know, the Toronto Film Festival is such a big deal. And so more of a good thing is a good thing, but also because, you know, Toronto, the city and the state and the, I mean, not the state, but the
province.
Thank you. And the nation have put state funding behind arts organizations. So I think that that'll be helpful. And to a lesser extent, the United States has done the same thing. Most film festivals that have paid employees are eligible for, you know, some of that support, the PPP support.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's not a ton of money. It'll help them get by. Maybe. We'll see. So that leaves, you know, you got the big boys who probably have enough cash crunch or can raise enough money with a capital campaign to keep motoring forward.
Right.
That their brand equity is going to keep them alive. It's the people in the middle.
Right.
Right. Who are going to have the hardest time, because maybe they did just get to the point where they had, you know, they were able to start paying people. And
right,
a full-time employee is more than just their salary. It's the taxes you pay on their salary. It's their health insurance.
Oh, yeah.
It's all that other kind of overhead. And, you know, I can see some of these medium-sized festivals really getting underwater in a hurry. And so they'll have to lay people off. And if you lay people off, you know, there goes some of the heart and soul of your festival. And it's hard to get those people back. And, you know, it changes the character of your festival. And so is it that maybe starts at the beginning of the end for some festivals? You know, medium to large festivals do go under, you know, especially, mm-hmm, as their founders move on or whatever. And this could accelerate that. But it's not – I haven't seen anyone who's – other than Telluride, who's, mm-hmm, a whole other beast, basically say, I'm not going to even try to do a virtual festival. You know, we're just going to cancel this year and we'll come back, or cancel and never come back. They're all trying to get on board with virtual screenings. And, you know, that'll be good for some people and not good for others.
For filmmakers, like, does it even make sense to submit to festivals this year?
So, yeah, if anybody's really getting screwed in this whole thing, it's filmmakers.
Shocking.
Because they don't know what the truth is. And right. The reason they don't know what the truth is that festivals don't know what the truth is. Exhibitors don't know what the truth is. Distributors don't know what the truth is. Everybody's just sort of, you know, winging it and pretending that, you know, the old rules still apply. Well, the old rules don't still apply. And there's this, you know, period of time where ain't nobody going to the movies, even after a vaccine and whatever, like people's habits will change. Mm-hmm. And they'll be like, you know what? I like being in my lazy boy with the, you know, 80-inch TV that I bought during the pandemic because I wasn't spending it on going out, right? Mm-hmm. You know? And, you know, maybe I don't need to do that. And, you know, we saw the collapse of the Windows. I think it was Universal and AMC. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah. Universal and AMC, they collapse.
You know, like, a film only has to be in theaters for like 9 weeks tops before they can put it out on
video. And that window's going to shrink even more because movie theaters have no negotiating power. At this point, they have no negotiating power. And I promise you, the moment that a big studio is forced to go to a PVOD platform on one of these films that they're just sitting on the shelf, because there's certain studios that are going to be able to hold on to these for a year. Like, I know my buddy worked on Top Gun. They just pushed that to next summer. And Marvel's slate is being pushed. But a studio like Sony, they need James Bond.
Yeah.
And if they don't release James
Bond. That's already started to happen. Like, I mean, what was the
– Trolls 2 is the big
– right?
Scoob. Yeah, Scoob kind of went that way. But we've only seen Trolls 2, Scooby, the new Scooby movie. I want to see a tentpole. I want to see a real studio movie. And that's going to be the litmus test. Because if – I promise you right now, if they release Bond, the new Bond, No Time to Die, right now – and go, guys, it's going to be on premium. It's going to be $20 this weekend. I think you'll make a killing. I think you'll do very well in this environment. Now, with that said, would it do better in a theatrical environment? Yes, I think it would. And there'd still be money for TVOD. But that could be a year, maybe even longer, like you said, maybe end of 2021 before we even start remotely going back to something that resembles what we had before. And even then, we haven't even spoken about the economy, which is, I still say, well, we have not seen the bottom yet. We haven't unfortunately seen the bottom yet of that. So we're not even taking place into all of that. And then of course the elections, and of course all the other turmoil around the world that's happening. So all of these pressures are being put on it. I mean, how long can you keep $200 million movie sitting on a shelf as a company? Like, if you pay $200 million for a product, you kind of got to get it, unless you've got cash reserves, which Disney, right, Warner's, Universal, they can hold. But some of the smaller, like Lionsgate or Paramount or even Sony, they need to release stuff theatrically. So they might just have to bite the bullet and go, you know what? Let's go to PVOD and we'll see. Theaters, I think, aren't going to have much. And anyway, Amazon's going to buy AMC anyway. I mean, that's just Amazon's going to buy AMC. Someone's buying. I called me and RB from Stage 32. I had him on the show a little while ago. I called Amazon on that show. I'm like, and then what's happening? Amazon's already circling. And what happened to the Egyptian? Netflix bought the Egyptian on Hollywood Boulevard. It's happening. Some big conglomerate's going to buy out AMC, Cinemark, ArcLight, because they're just going to go under. They can't not. They have no money coming in, man.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, there's going to be a fire sale on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
AMC owns a lot of real estate, or the developers who, you know, brought AMC own a lot of real estate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there used to be, back in the 90s, there was this big push to put theaters out on the boony outskirts of town.
Yep.
With, you know, a big ass parking lot and like a Steak and Shake and a Chili's and a whatever. Like,
sure.
You know, the movie theater wasn't the thing making money. The movie theater was the thing bringing the money to all the other businesses. Right. So there's a lot of those still around. And, you know,
don't forget the malls.
Some of that real estate.
Don't forget the malls.
Can, you know, if I had to like lay some money down, I would say there's going to be fewer movie theaters.
Yes. Period. Fewer screens. Fewer screens in the country.
Right. And this will, you know, as with so many things, this will accelerate that. But to bring it back to what does this mean for filmmakers? Filmmakers don't know whether they should be looking at film festivals and saying, I should submit because this is, you know, my film's ready and I want to get it out there. Or, you know, is this going to invalidate my film's premiere in the eyes of a distributor who sees that as lost revenue?
Right.
2 months ago in May, 3 months ago, whatever it is, Brian Newman, who runs a consulting company called Subgenre, where he helps brands make sort of documentary and indie films and get them out there.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of him.
Brian's a great guy, and he made this big argument that you should not be submitting to film festivals. And at the time, I completely agreed with him because, you know, distributors had not gotten on board with the idea that, you know, that having your film premiere online was a good thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
In just the paltry, you know, 6-8 weeks since then, that thinking has evolved, and you're hearing more and more distributors say things like, well, so long as it's, you know, so long as you only sell 1,000 views, right? So long as you limit the number of people who can see it, so long as you only make it available for 3 days, so long as you can geo-block mm-hmm. it so that only people in the city of New York can watch it, then, you know, we'll view that as just a regular old festival screening, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So the rules are changing. My argument for a filmmaker who is maybe new to the game or doesn't have a whole lot of money sunk into, you know, we need to go find a distribution deal for this right now. My advice for them is hold on, because the one thing that, you know, a virtual festival can almost never offer you, unless it's like one of the really big ones, and I'll talk about that in a second, is networking opportunities.
Correct.
Hot Docs did a really good job. Hot Docs is a documentary festival in Toronto mm-hmm. that is sort of like the documentary answer to TIFF. It's in the spring, yada, yada. But they do a lot of, you know, sales. They do a lot of like cooking distributors up with the filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
And they did all of that online this year. And apparently did really well. Just as many films sold, just as many meetings taken from the reading I've been doing. And, you know, it was a rousing success. But they had already been going down that road because, you know, fewer distributors came to Hot Docs because it was, you know, in the spring with a bunch of other stuff. Every other film festival that you might go to, especially the medium and small ones, they can't afford to make those kinds of connections or don't think to make those kinds of connections between filmmakers and each other, between filmmakers and distributors, between filmmakers and executives or whatever. They're like, we put a film online, maybe we have a Q&A on Skype, and that's what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And that eliminates all of that halo activity, all that stuff that takes place around where the filmmakers meet each other and decide to go to the bar right next door and really get to know each other and, you know, form, you know, some sort of partnership or alliance, all that kind of good stuff that makes film festivals worth submitting to in the first place.
No, but can filmmakers get the same kind of exposure online as they got from, like, so let's say you got into South By and you premiered on that Amazon PVOD thing that they did. Did that help? Did they get more attention? Did they not? What are you feeling?
What I noticed and what I have seen in some of the press since is that a lot of the features that were selected mm-hmm. and as narrative features and doc features chose not to participate.
Right. I know that from inside. Exactly.
So whether that was because of the financial terms or whether that was because they, you know, it, that was early days. That was what?
Oh, it's Wild Wild West.
May,
yeah, it was Wild Wild West at that point. And I know what it was. It was like you got paid like, I don't know, like $500 or something like that. It was something really insulting.
Yeah. But it's a whole different animal, right? It's an entirely different thing.
Business model.
Our distributors, you know, sitting down in their living rooms and going through the slate and, you know, like there's a reason that distributors like going to film festivals. It's not just about getting access to the films. They can do that on their own. They pick up the phone, they call the filmmaker, they say, hey, I can't make it to South by Southwest. Can you give me a screening link? And the filmmaker goes, well, of course, right? They can see the movies. It's about the social interactions. It's about the deal making. It's about seeing what the audience thought of the film when they saw it. And that sort of atmosphere of collegialism and, you know, getting to know the new kids and, you know, talent spotting. And very little of that takes place online unless your festival can make a really concerted effort to make those connections. Are there things that are better about virtual film festivals? Yeah. I mean, a distributor can only afford to send so many people to South by Southwest, but if everything's happening online, they can put 3-4 people on it and take that many more meetings.
Right.
As a filmmaker, your decision should be based on factors like how likely is my film to quote unquote expire? Right. If this is a film about the upcoming election, you need to get it out there.
Right.
It's not going to be any good to anybody after that. If yours is a coming of age comedy that will play out pretty much the same in 2022 as it will in 2021, then my advice is wait, you know, unless there's extenuating circumstances. But, you know, everything's highly personal. There are going to be a lot of films that get out there on the festival circuit. My feeling is that a lot of them will have already have achieved distribution before they hit the festival circuit. And that playing festivals means that they're kind of a niche film that maybe needs some festival play to generate word of mouth. Mm-hmm. So maybe an LGBT film or an African-American film that, you know, they need a way to reach audiences. It's going to be really difficult for indies with no distribution to take that chance. And then, you know, the worry is that a distributor's going to go, oh yeah, well you played 4 online film festivals and, you know, now the online market for that has played out. What are the extenuating circumstances? It's all an economy. The more scarce films become, finished produced films, right? Because that, you know, there's not a lot of production going on right now. The more of those, the more need for that content there is, the more valuable, the more willing those distributors are going to be to overlook the fact that you played to 4,000 online viewers.
Right.
It's a calculus for sure.
And but again, nobody knows anything at this point. Like nobody knows
at this very moment, what we know is that it's unlikely that anybody's going to be doing any production or holding any festivals of any kind. Right. To something that already has distribution. And we're going to see the same slate of films across a bunch of festivals for the next 6 to 12 months.
Right. And
say, I need to get my film out there now. I don't care. Right.
Right.
And that happens. People don't make, you know, logical decisions all the time.
No, exactly. It's like, imagine if you've been working a year and a half on a movie and then it's ready and now this happens. You're like, I don't want to wait another year and a half, but, and my investors want their money back or something like that. Well, it's just, you know, you could just be, you know, instinctual and just release it now and see what happens, or you could be more strategic and wait and see what happens. Now I have to ask you though, you know, to talk about the elephant in the room, Sundance. Is it going to happen in 2021, in your opinion?
Well, they've already announced a plan. Mm-hmm. Did you see this?
No, I've heard. I didn't hear the details, so if you could please tell me.
Okay. So the plan is, and this plan is now a couple of weeks old before the real, you know, even anecdotal studies of the airborne qualities of this virus came out, is to hold a limited number of in-theater screenings at 20 different cities around the country, around the U.S. I don't think they announced any international, but I could be wrong about that. Mm-hmm. In addition to a slate of films at Utah. The slate of films, there would be like a core, as I understand it, and then programmers in other cities will help curate for local audiences. Oh. And they'll all be socially distanced and whatever, and there will be an online component to it as well.
I mean, it's just by, I mean, that's all with a lot of assumptions.
Right. And that's not till after the inauguration in January. They pushed their dates back. Mm-hmm. And that's not for months and months from, you know, it's what, 4 months at this point. Five if you count the full of January. So they got lots of time to change their mind.
And they probably, yeah.
May yet.
Yeah.
But their plan, based on all that old information, is, well, we can do this socially distanced and we're going to try. If anybody can try to do it, we're going to try. So they're in talks with theaters and whoever else around the world, and they're going to try and make it happen. Do I think it's going to happen? I'd put it at about 60-40 against at this point.
I would agree.
Just because we know things now we didn't know before, and it seems like a really, really bad idea to put no money. I mean, I just don't understand how the economics of it work.
If you're going to tell me that they're going to do drive-ins, then maybe. Maybe drive-ins. Like if they're going to do 20 cities, drive-in pop-ups that they'll do in like a Walmart, you know, parking lot or a mall parking lot or something like that. That might make sense to me. And if someone could do it, Sundance can, because out of everybody in the U.S., Sundance has the biggest cachet and arguably some of the biggest cachet in the world as far as film festivals are concerned. So they might be able to draw an audience.
Yes. Drive-ins are an interesting problem because they accomplish the social separation, but they have other problems, including line of sight, including carbon monoxide, you know, including weather, which is where carbon monoxide becomes a problem.
Oh yeah. And if it's going to be in the winter, depending on the city you're in, those cars are going to have to be running.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have to be.
Well, freeze.
There's a drive-in in Michigan that actually has electric heaters that are, you know, powered by extension cords. So they bring out to the car an extension cord and this thing, and they put the heater down on the floorboards, and that's how they do it in the winter.
It's 1952 again.
Basically. But there's a whole bunch of logistical challenges. And the only thing that Sundance would have going for it in January is that they can probably get 2, maybe 3 screenings a night, since sundown is what, 7 o'clock or whatever.
Right.
You know, whereas in the summer and sundown's not till 8:30, 9 o'clock, you're in trouble. So yeah. Drive-ins are an interesting problem. You've got bathrooms to consider. Like I now know how much it costs to rent a deluxe porta potty setup per day in the city of Atlanta. Because we're doing the research on, you know, how do we make drive-ins a thing. So yeah, it's all very interesting.
So do you see, I mean, after this passes, and hopefully it will pass in the next few years, and we will revamp back up to where we were, I'm hoping, or is this, you know, or COVID could be with us for many, many years to come in one way, shape, or form, like the flu or whatever after the vaccines and all that kind of stuff, whatever the future might lie. Do you believe that film festivals will now either have to or will now always have an online component, even if they have a physical event?
What I think is going to happen, and this is based on my many, many decades of – no, I'm kidding.
Sure.
What I think is going to happen is that this will open festivals' eyes to the power of reaching out to your audience digitally in a way that they have just not tried to do before.
Right.
They're going to figure out, hey, we can produce video. We can produce remote interviews and Q&As. And, you know, even in a big in-person theater setting, we can make it work and we can make it valuable. So I think that part's going to stick. I don't know from a distribution and online revenue kind of thing. Like even if movie theaters were to go away tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the only people showing in movie theaters are film festivals. The distribution is still there, and they're still going to view any sort of online screening sort of widely available as cutting into their possible sales. Mm-hmm. So I don't see film festivals going entirely virtual in a big way, or even like majority virtual. It's going to be an add-on, right? The value is still in the in-person
sure
experience. The value is in seeing your friends at the theater, in red the conversations carpet that you have in the parking lot, in the filmmaker you got to meet, in all of that. That's not going away. And one of the reasons we know it's not going away is because, you know, hardly anybody pays for music anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. When was the last time you bought an album?
Right.
Digital distribution killed, you know, a lot of the revenue for recordings for musicians. But now, you know, they make their living schlepping around the country or the
not
world.
Not now, but yes, in theory.
Well, right, right. Well, okay, now they're online, right? And some of them are charging, you know, money or doing whatever, you know, to they're on Patreon and they do a nightly concert or whatever. They're finding ways to interact with their audience and get value out of that. So festivals will continue and perhaps have to up the ante in terms of interaction and making that in-person experience valuable. But I mean, I think everybody's anxious to get back to butts in seats in the dark, watching a movie together.
Now, wouldn't it make sense though for film festivals, which have an educational aspect to them with panels and talks and things like that, to offer those digitally where you could charge? Like if you had Mark Duplass doing that amazing South by Southwest keynote about filmmaking, couldn't you charge $15 a head or $25 for a pass for the day or whatever it is to see that as a revenue generator and open that stuff up to a worldwide audience that might not be able to come to the festival?
Possibly. A lot of them do that already. A lot of the bigger ones anyway, right? Mm-hmm. They're taking their talks that were recorded and they parcel them out over the course of the year on YouTube or whatever. Some of them generating revenue from ads, some of them.
But I'm talking about live, like doing a live event. Okay,
I'm getting there. Mm-hmm. Some of them is just as a tent pole to draw more attention. So they're already selling their garbage, so to mm-hmm. speak. Mm-hmm. The question you're asking is, can they grab some of those people? And my answer to that is, number one, there's a bunch of logistics issues there, right? And it's a lot harder to sell a $600 pass for something that you get sitting on your butt in your own living room.
Oh, no, you're not going to be able to. That's a completely different business model. There's right. no question right. you can charge that. But let's say if you charge $50 for the day per day and you get, you know, 20 panels that you have access to on the day that shut down the next day. Like you won't have access to them again. So for that window, and then at the end, if you want to get access to all of the interviews, all of the panels, all of the things, you sell a package for like $200-$300 and you have it for life. I mean, I'm just thinking outside the box here.
I think the fear would be that they would be cannibalizing their own sales. Because, you know, companies spend a lot of money outside of the price of the badge to send somebody to South by Southwest. Mm-hmm. Hotels are nearly impossible to get. Flights are impossible to get. It's a lot of money to get somebody's physical atom-based butt out to, you know, Austin, Texas for that. But they know that, A, the person that is going is really excited about it and is going to, like, really get a lot out of it. And so that's why they do that. But if you said the same thing, well, you can get all the informational content at the same time for, you know, a fraction of the cost, then there's a lot of companies that are going to do that. So I think there's a fear-based element there. There's a political element of, if we do that and our attendance starts to go down, how does that look for us and for our city that now depends on us to bring in a bunch of revenue, yada, yada, yada. I mean, there's a lot of economic and emotional reasons not to do that. But I think you're right that this will open their eyes to the possibility of charging for that content. And I think filmmakers should, you know, there was a time when just being on the panel was enough. You're getting the exposure and you're being highlighted. Yeah, but they're selling tickets based on your ass too. So maybe ask for a little bit of that. Maybe ask for a free hotel room, whatever.
Yeah, that's another question. I've always had a problem with film festivals. Ours, they're making a ton of money off of our films, and they're not. I know they're not.
They're not making a ton of money off of the films. Certainly not off of ticket sales.
So they're making it off the sponsors.
Right. A film festival's job is to get its audience to show up in happy, enthusiastic, alcoholic droves. Mm-hmm. Right? That is their job.
That's the most honest definition of a film festival ever.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
We do this for two reasons. Number one, sponsors who pay way more than an audience member per head that shows up there, you know, like to be part of something that's successful, mm-hmm. right? They like, this is why tickets for festivals are still down around 15, 20 bucks per show when it costs way more than that, right? I think we did the calculations at the Atlanta Film Festival one time, and throwing in like sponsorship and volunteer labor, mm-hmm. you know, if we'd had to pay all those people, if we didn't have the sponsorship money, in order to break even, we would have had to charge, I think it was like around $100 a ticket to break even.
Wow.
So, you know, and most festivals, you know, are only breaking even. You know, they're just barely surviving. There are those lucky few who are, you know, and 99% of them are nonprofits. But even the big ones like South by Southwest, it ain't the film festival that's making, you know, the big money there. It's the tech conference.
And the music conference. Yeah.
And, you know, but it's the movies and the celebrities and the whatnot that help convince the tech workers that they want to come out for that, right? And right. that's why they request a ticket to South by Southwest instead of some other more boring conference.
Right.
Because they know it's going to be a good time. So when you look at big film festivals and you go, oh, they're making a lot of money, it's usually something else going on there. And, you know, the other – when I mentioned the alcohol, that is partially about sponsors but also about tax revenue. You know, mm-hmm. bars pay a lot in tax revenue, and if you got people coming to party in your town, that makes the city really happy, and then they give you grant money to keep doing what you're doing.
Kind of like the San Diego Comic-Con when it takes over San Diego. Yeah. I mean, it's the South by Southwest of its town. Yep. And I mean, we're talking about 150,000 people show up for 5 days.
You got it.
And this year I was on a virtual panel for the Comic-Con, and I did a virtual panel because I would have loved to go, but that's not happening.
Yep.
I mean, the one thing I keep telling people is like the hangover effect of COVID, the COVID hangover effect, which is even if tomorrow Fauci comes on and says, hey, we have a vaccine, it's worked, it's 100%. You take it, you'll never get this thing. We've defeated it. If that in a magical world would happen tomorrow, I still say it takes 6 months, a year, possibly longer before most of the population feels comfortable being around other people again in the way we were in January of 2019 or 2020. Would you agree?
See, I see, and maybe this is just my perspective from deep red Georgia, although not so much deep red anymore, but I see a lot of people still out and about, even without the vaccine.
I said most.
I don't think it's even most. I think if it were most, you know, we wouldn't, and this is getting political and scientific and whatever, and I'm basing this just on the fact that, you know, I go out and pick up my groceries curbside or whatever. Mm-hmm. In the limited amount of time that I am outdoors, mm-hmm. you know, my family took a completely isolated road trip where we just drove for 5 hours just because we could not stand being in the house any longer.
Yes.
And, you know, we're driving through both the city of Atlanta and the outskirts and out in rural Georgia. And I see people out and about hanging at outdoor venues, drinking and eating and just having a grand old time, I'm not convinced that it's most people who are staying indoors and isolating. And that it's probably different in California.
Sure.
You've got some pretty draconian, you know, but is it most people? It may be regional as well. So
okay. It's all relative.
I think there are going to be two things. There's going to be those people who didn't give a crap in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And there are going to be those who have been going stir crazy. And once they get that shot,
they're out.
It's going to come roaring back for them. Will there be people in the meantime who have discovered that they can live a perfectly content life working at home and not going out and not eating out and just doing their thing and their lifestyle is better that way? Sure. But my worry about the hangover is less about personal behavior and whether we feel like being together or not, and more about the availability of the vaccine and the willingness of people to take it.
Yeah.
People who don't, anyway,
that's a whole other conversation. Yeah. Gotcha. I gotcha.
Yeah.
The reason I said the hangover is because, you know, I personally don't know when I'll be able to sit down in a movie theater with a group of people again. Like, it's going to be a while before I feel comfortable doing that. And I love the movies.
You have common sense, Alex.
It's just, you know, so I feel that there's definitely, let's say it's 30% of the population. That's a substantial amount of revenue that the industry mm-hmm. will lose. So there's still going to be a hangover effect, regardless, whatever that percentage is, it's still going to be a bigger, it's going to be a chunk of what it normally was in January of 2020. And again, we're not factoring in the economy.
No, which spending habits change.
Oh,
right?
No question. People are like, maybe I don't have to go out so much. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the people who lost their income
mm-hmm.
probably were not the people who were spending tons of money on entertainment in the first place.
Right.
So entertainment's a luxury. And, you know, it's not one of those things that is as susceptible to an economic downturn, because the people who had the cushion to afford that stuff in the first place probably still have enough of a cushion to do some spending there. And their spending habits change. The spending habits of the truly wealthy who don't have to worry about this stuff, they're dumping more money into at-home entertainment. They're right. spending more money on video games. They're subscribing to more streaming services.
Right.
If anything, this is just going to bolster the position of streaming services, because before it was like so fractured and you didn't want to spend $100, $200 a month on all these different streaming services. Now it seems like a bargain.
Right. Yeah, because you're not going out as much. So it makes sense. Well, exactly. I mean, Chris, the whole world's coming. The whole world's burning.
It's all going to shirt.
It's all going to shirt in the hand basket, sir.
Right.
All right. I'm going to ask you a couple of rapid fire questions in regards to film festivals. And I want to hear what you think. Do you submit it to a film festival right now?
Well, the very long-winded answer that I gave earlier is it depends. Mm-hmm. And if you want to shoot me an email at chris@filmfestivalsecrets.com and tell me your situation, and I'll give you a rapid-fire answer of my gut based on having not seen your film at all and you having described it to me, you're welcome to do that. I don't promise I'll get back to you soon. I'll get back to you.
All right. And my next question was, if not now, when? So when and what in what's the environment that makes sense to start submitting back to film festivals if you're waiting?
I think when film festivals announce that they are holding their next events 100% in person, or, you know, as close to it as they will ever get again, right? Like, if they're like, we're showing 100 films and each of them twice and, you know, it's all going to be in theaters. And, oh, by the way, we're doing this virtual thing over here. That to me is fully back. Until we see that from film festivals, because, mm-hmm. you know, they don't want to get sued. You know, mm-hmm. they don't mm-hmm. want to become or have a bad reputation of being a spread vector.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's, you know, they're not going to hold an in-person event. As an aside, there's a lot of film festival and event organizers who are now armchair virologists. These people have learned more about, you know, how to keep themselves out of trouble with their insurance companies and their lawyers and whatever else mm-hmm. by becoming medical experts than I think they ever thought was going to happen.
And if you are accepted into an online festival or a festival that has an online component now, what can you do to make the most out of it as a filmmaker?
Participate in any virtual events that they have to offer, you know, make yourself available for all of that. Make sure that you read the fine print on exactly who's going to be able to see your film and when and where and how and all that. You do not want to get run afoul of, you know, oh, well, it turned out it was available worldwide and that's going to screw our distribution chances. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, ask them what opportunities they have for you to connect with other filmmakers and with the industry. Even before all this happened, one of my favorite things to do for film festivals that I worked with was just start a private Facebook group for all the filmmakers who were accepted that year and just let them get to know each other. And they would partner up on hotel rooms. They would, you know, compare the schedules and see like what films they wanted to see. You know, it was just a good way to build connections even before you put boots on the ground at the festival. So for online, that may be the only interaction you have with another filmmaker. And those are the connections that are really worth making at film festivals.
And where can people find you? Oh, wait a minute. First of all, don't you have an updated book version, sir, of your best-selling book, Film Festival Secrets?
Oh, man, you're such a good shill. I'm going to keep you. Yes. So right before the pandemic started, I released the second edition of Film Festival Secrets, a handbook for independent filmmakers. The book is very much changed since it was first published in 2008. Mm-hmm. It does not mention MySpace anymore. It no longer.
What are you talking about? That's the secret. That's the secret. This is a good place to make
filmmakers social.
Absolutely. Man. I mean, that's where everyone. Quiet, don't tell anybody. Yeah, that's right. And if we go there, if you go there and we're not there, just wait.
Right. Exactly. yeah. So it's updated with all the new stuff.
Got it.
Does not mention DVDs as a submission format or anything. And by popular demand, I have added a directory of 1,400 notable film festivals around the world that I have personally put my eyes on their website or know them by reputation or have talked to their directors or whatever that I think are legit. So if you're one of those filmmakers who's worried that they're going to get scammed and the person's not going to watch their film and, you know, it's not worth it, this list basically tells you, yeah, these festivals are legit. I make no promises beyond that. I don't call them the best. I don't call them the coolest. I don't call them the ultimate. They're just notable, you know, good deal film festivals.
And where can people get the book? And yeah, where
filmfestivalsecrets.com or on Amazon.
And it's in paperback. It's an ebook.
It is in paperback. It's a bit more expensive in paperback because mm-hmm. those are atoms mm-hmm. That have to be physically shipped somewhere. But yeah, I wanted to make it as accessible and affordable as possible and still prove to my wife that, you know, it was worth me spending all that time doing what I was doing. But yeah, please. I mean, take a look because I feel like the genesis of the book was I was working at the Austin Film Festival. I was listening to the programmers answer phone calls from filmmakers, and they kept answering the same questions over and over again. And so I thought somebody ought to like write all this stuff down and put it in a book. And it turned out a few years later, that person was me.
And there you go.
So I think it's, you know, I hope it's really helpful to people who are coming on the circuit.
And where can people find you?
I am primarily at filmfestivalsecrets.com. I'm on Twitter at Film Fest Secrets. I'm not there a ton. Facebook is not really my thing. There is an Instagram, but that's not really my thing either.
Do you have a thing, sir? Do you have a thing?
Do I have a thing? Well, I'll tell you about a thing I've been working on. It is a new podcast for the film festival I work for, the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. Mm-hmm. It's called AJFF in Conversation, and it is about all things film with a Jewish spin on it. So if you're Jewish or just curious about Jewish film festivals and Jewish film, I'm producing it. The two other staff members are hosting it, but I'm pretty proud of what we've done. It's one of those things that I don't think we would have done without the pandemic coming along. It's right. A way of connecting to our audiences. I think it's something that filmmakers should consider mm-hmm. in light of the fact that they may not get a theatrical run or the festival run in theatrical way. Mm-hmm. It's like, what other digital content can you put out there to connect with your audience? Because all the cool kids are doing it. You
know? And again, if we've learned anything, MySpace, that's
MySpace. I'm pretty sure I still have a MySpace account. Tom is still my friend. He's solid. Man. He's never let
He's never let us down.
That's right. He's always there. He's always in my top eight.
It's so Jesus, that just took me way back.
Didn't it?
Man, the top eight. Oh my God. Anyway, Chris, man, thank you so much for being on the show again. And
my pleasure. Always good to talk to you.
And helping us guide us through the treacherous world of film festivals in the COVID landscape. And it is an ever changing world. It'll probably change and it will change again in the next week or two before and after this thing. It's going to constantly change. But I appreciate you taking the time, man. Stay safe out there.
My pleasure. You too.
I want to thank Chris for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Chris. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get a hold of Chris, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/428. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.